I want to offer a political, analytic, and legal set of perspectives on the globalization of the Me Too movement, with focus on sexual harassment. And it is definitely true that you can't solve a problem you don't name. And that continues to be true of a lot of problems that are running around out there in the world that have yet to be captured and named and defined. So, you know, it just thinking in terms of among the major lessons of the little piece of biography offered just so generously by David there, there are a lot of things that still need to be named, a lot of problems that aren't being solved because they aren't being named. So sexual harassment is global because, and I know you all know this, but just to say something very basic, because the sexual abuse of power is nearly universal. And the sexual abuse of power specifically is in almost all societies a feature of masculinity as a normalized social definition under conditions of male dominance, socially speaking, over women as a group who are a subordinated group. And, you know, this varies considerably both within societies, within groups, as well as across societies, but it is difficult to find a place where it doesn't happen. But I say this just to be clear that sexual abuse, as of course you saw from the earlier panels, certainly is not exclusively a Western phenomenon, nor is it a white problem, although it is pandemic as well as endemic in both of those sectors and groups, and does take culturally specific forms everywhere. You know, this seems to sort of throw people off in that, I mean, you would think that if people weren't riding around in South Africa in hoods and setting off crosses burning, that there was no racism in South Africa. Like, by definition, in other words, people will take the form in which sexual harassment occurs in their own culture and then act as if they can't see it in some other culture, or it doesn't exist in that other culture. Or people in that other culture will say, if people in their culture identify it as existing in their culture, then they only understand it by contagion from some other culture rather than it being endemic in each. And the same is true for groups and cultural groups within each country. And actually, what I have come to notice is that all forms of violence against women are cultural everywhere. And there just is no place where sexual harassment is not cultural. It's so interesting the way the term cultural has come up around the Me Too movement, and people are speaking about it in terms of cultural change. But, you know, implicit in that, I just want to sort of take this out of our discussion right here at the outset, is the notion that there may be a cultural defense to sexual harassment. That is to say, this is just his culture. This is just the way he courts, or just the way they initiate the building of families, for example, abduction and rape. It's still abduction and rape. You don't get a cultural defense because, you know, typically that's the way it's been done in one's culture. So it means only, actually, that it takes a worldwide movement that recognizes these commonalities to eliminate the problem. And today we are seeing that movement, and Me Too is it. Or at least one manifestation of the high-level, visible surface of it. So what is being reported under the rubric of sexual harassment? First of all, sexual harassment has always been, and is now still, sexual pressure or sexual violation by someone with more power against someone with less power, who typically that second person is not in a position to effectively resist or refuse very often. So sexual harassment as a larger phenomenon, and we are seeing this in the sexual, in the Me Too reporting, either encompasses within it or links to, often both, all forms of sexual violation and exploitation. For example, sexual harassment can and often does include rape. So people who use the locution sexual harassment or sexual violence or sexual harassment or sexual misconduct are, those are misnomers. In other words, there is rape that is not, or that is recognized separate from sexual harassment law, but rape often is sexual harassment. If it is under conditions of inequality of power and inflicted by someone with more power on someone with less. The other thing, having mentioned the term sexual misconduct, I'd just like to say is I think people are in love with the term, especially schools and sometimes corporations, because it has no legal meaning. I am thinking here of rape as something, as a sexual intrusion that is coerced under circumstances of inequality or by dominant power. I'm thinking of it in those terms, which is, of course, a much broader definition, and the law doesn't recognize that very often as rape, but I'll talk about that a little more. In addition, in terms of what's encompassed here and is being reported widely in terms, including in Me Too, but is all over the reported case law, sexual harassment can include pornography, which is frequently reported forced on the victim, happens in workplaces quite frequently, or in many instances made of the person being victimized through the sexual assault. Now, as to links of sexual harassment with what are considered quote-unquote other forms of sexual abuse, I just want to point out, first of all, these are not actually really other forms of sexual abuse. There is sexual abuse that, you know, occurs in various sectors at various points in a person's life cycle, often repeatedly in a person's life, but, you know, first in their home, you know, then on the street, or and family, then, you know, in school, including elementary school, then they go to work and it's happening to them there, etc., and continues in the family. So, but just to notice, the dynamics of sexual harassment are the same as the dynamics of childhood sexual abuse. That is to say, in which someone with more power than you have forces, usually but not always, himself on someone with less power. That's the dynamic of childhood sexual abuse. It is also what is sexual about it to the perpetrator. And why it is sexually violating to the victim. The institutional responses to childhood sexual abuse also are often very similar to those institutional responses to sexual harassment. This is called institutional betrayal by the scholar Jennifer Freed, F-R-E-Y-D, in her work on sexual harassment in education, which appropriately is talking about betrayal of the institution in loco parentis in relation to sexually harassed students, either by faculty or higher administrators or by other students, in parallel with what is often the betrayal first by parents and then by legal institutions of young people, boys as well as girls, more boys than anyone has any idea of, I'm here to tell you, as well as girls about which we know a little bit more, and the numbers are very high. Actually, if you do the math on what is both known about who was sexually abused in childhood in numbers, and this was done in San Francisco in 1977 in a probability sample by Diana Russell. And then you take the studies of who it is on a particular day actually doesn't remember having been sexually abused as a child when there is a hospital report of that abuse of that person 30 years prior. And there's a brilliant study. It was a retrospective study and really, really smart. And if you do the math on that, you're talking over half of all women in the United States were sexually abused in physical forms before they reached the age of majority. Okay, so that's our floor. This is how and where we enter here. And then those dynamics become what is sexuality to us. That is, two girls were taught femininity is submission to sexual imposition by those who have more power than we do, and we're taught to be supposed to sexualize that. And boys are taught the way not to have that done to you ever again is to either A, identify with the abuse, call that your sexuality, and sexualize power being exercised over you by a man typically, but not always, or disidentify with women and think that all you can do is either have it done to you or do it, and therefore do it as a strategy for not having it done to you, aka masculinity. In other words, sexual abuse in childhood explains more about everything that we're seeing in this area than any other single thing does. And then the institutional responses are similar. We can talk about Leslie Levy's excellently put question about damages for that later, but it's if you embed it in that analysis, you get a different answer than the law often gives, actually. Okay, and then in addition, I would, as another link, I would point out that sexual harassment in employment, which is actually requiring sexual access be exchanged for economic survival under conditions of inequality, actually makes all forms of work into a form of prostitution. And as with prostitution, where pimps typically take most of the proceeds, and almost vast majority of women in prostitution are pimped, sexually harassed workers in real work, in real jobs, often don't survive it economically either because somebody else is profiting, both sexually and economically. So just a couple of links. Now, the central dynamic of sexual harassment is, in this analysis, inequality. It has shares this in common with all forms of sexual abuse. It also shares in common all the inequalities to which women are subjected. And this includes racial subordination, age differentials, class and status and wealth differentials, which are exploited to gain. It's like, what gives him the drop on her is what I'm asking here. And this includes things like the power of the state, for instance, police. That gives them the drop. Immigration status gives them the drop. You know, suck my penis or I'll turn you into the ICE or your family, etc. In addition, sexual orientation and gender identity are exploited in sexual harassment and used. And first and last, but of course by no means only, sex and gender stratification. Now, these what are called intersectional dimensions that I have mentioned, noted here, are not just add-ons to the sex and gender. This is not a this and a that and a that. These are what makes a person be who they are altogether. In other words, I have met lots of men and women, I've met lots of white people and black people, but I've never met a white person who wasn't either a man or a woman, or a black person, you see what I'm saying, a person who, like a woman who wasn't black or white or some combination thereof or whatever. Everyone has an ethnicity and a sex or a gender or both or neither or a repudiation of them, whatever, however one orients toward these things. So this is not a, in reality, one plus one plus one or whatever. And actually, structural social hierarchies are created in which people are embedded of these inequalities, and these all precede social organization. That is, formal social organizations, like schools, like the workplace. I mentioned schools and the workplace because these are two recognized hierarchies. I think they're, I mean, and they're recognized because the civil rights movement prohibited discrimination in them. And therefore, we have data on the ways in which people are subordinated within them. That's why they're recognized, but also I think, given that the black civil rights movement had a much, much larger agenda, a lot of which was not embodied in law, those are recognized as hierarchies not because they're not important, they are absolutely crucial, but because white men understand that you can be subjected to a hierarchy within those. There's a superior, in other words, white men know what it is to have a boss. They know what it is to have a teacher over them, someone in whose power and control they have ever been. Therefore, that's a recognized place. That's where they'll see that there's an inequality taking place if it's being misused. So sexual harassment in those two sectors has then become visible, and with what was called campus sexual assault is where it became visible in schools in the last number of years. And with Me Too and Time's Up at work, it became visible. Then, not because these are the only places where sexual harassment occurs, but actually, I mean, of course, there's abuse by police, there's by religious leaders, which has become visible to some extent. By doctors, we're finally beginning to see, in relation to, you've seen the Olympic athletes, etc., but doctors have been doing this all across the board forever. Lawyers preying on their divorce clients, EY preying on their divorce clients, and so on. And, you know, there are sometimes legal actions against that, especially here in California. I mention this only just to say that the places in which we most visibly and vividly know about sexual harassment taking place, it is not confined to those places. Okay. They've been able to become public because, as I said, there are equality laws there. And those equality laws have been interpreted to include sexual harassment because of the vision, the indomitability, and the leadership exercised by African American women as plaintiffs, who are the ones who led on this. They were the first plaintiffs in the cases. I mean, they are my clients, so I know who I'm talking about, both in employment and in education, who established the law on this. The first people who stood up and said, you know, this is what discrimination looks like. Actually, it's because I'm a woman. And they weren't, they saw through it, they saw through the flattery, they saw through everyone else's sort of resignation to the abuse as being just life, which is the typical, has always been the response to it. No, not for them. And, you know, so that is why, I mean, and they saw the systemic connections. They didn't think it was just about them personally. They knew it wasn't. And they knew this in substantial part because they knew that they are not enslaved anymore, just to put it very briefly. So then sexual harassment surfaces some 40 years later in the Me Too movement in some approximate proportion to its well-known pervasiveness. And it's a huge cultural upheaval. Notice, women have been talking about this with each other, and sometimes with trusted men also, for centuries. But nothing was done about it. So here are women talking about it again, and the Me Too moment, the Me Too movement, the biggest mobilization against sexual abuse in history, really raises the question, why all of a sudden was something done about it? And I just want to offer a couple brief answers, attempt at that, because I actually think I know. And, you know, you can tell me this is wrong or add to this or however, but it's for our thinking. I think it's because conventional media reported the story of one powerful man getting away with abusing many high-status women over decades as if it was real and as if it was not exceptional. It had everything to do with how it was reported and where. There was no sensationalism around the Harvey Weinstein thing. I think I can tell you, I don't think many men masturbated to reading that story. And there was no sexualizing of the abuse. And then the Times, instead of doing what the Times just alone, but all of them always do, didn't just use it to sell papers, they kept reporting it. And they reported it up and down status hierarchies, across sectors of work. They reported it in restaurants. They reported it at the Ford plant with these gorgeous pictures, big, beautiful pictures, showing profile, whole body pictures showing these women with real dignity, who had reported it and had been fighting it since the 1980s. Now, Ashley Judd actually made this possible. Since we're talking about a why, let's look at a direct causal effect here by having the bravery to allow her name to be used. And she has attributed getting a lot of that courage from women in prostitution in India, the same group of women I work with in India, who have told their stories about why they're there and what they want out of life, which is not that. And that helped give her the courage to let her name be used so that conventional journalistic norms could be scrupulously followed and you'd have a named source against Harvey Weinstein rather than flying off with these horrendous allegations and everyone who was making them, even if for extremely good reasons, keeping their names out of it. You know, you had at least one person, and then there was a second. Okay, so once she was willing to go forward. And then we had Jodi Kantor, the journalist, who had been researching this for a long time. She really had the goods on this guy and had real facts, real details, extensive, documented, tracked down, triple sourced times, dates, places, things. And then so that you could see the convergence of the experiences of the various women in a way that supported the credibility of each of them. You want to know why it worked? I think this is why. And in addition, then, we had quickly what I think is really brilliant piece of journalism in addition by Ronan Farrow in The New Yorker. And always one's personal story could be told in a better, fuller way, and I'm sure that's true of those accounts. And the women in them can always tell them better than a journalist can tell it for them. But he quoted them extensively. And actually, I fired my television after the election, but happened to be on the road and saw him be interviewed about it. And the interviewer was saying, oh, come on, Ronan, don't you think there's really a personal dimension to this? And you and your father being Woody Allen and your sister having said he sexually abused her and all this and you're being on her side and blah, 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 blah. He lets this journalist go on. And then he just looks at them and says, you know, I think actually know that this is about the women that I talk to. And then he stopped. Right? So the journalist said, but really, come on. I mean, can't there be a tiny piece of personal vindication that you're getting out of this? And he said, no, actually, I think you should listen to these women. I'm telling you, Yale Law School did not teach him that. But anyway, he learned it somewhere, and you know, so I think that was extremely effective. A remarkable piece, both of those pieces of journalism. And then this high-level cultural opening that we had, social media with Tarana Burke's really inspired hashtag from 2015, produced further visibility and documentation without any editorial interference, so that all the ways that women themselves would choose to say, me too, this happened to me, 500,000 of them within a blink of an eye, et cetera, you know, could proceed to do that. In other words, once the conventional media, one, believed, and two, valued the survivors, these are two separate things, folks. They overlap. I mean, if you value the person, you're more likely to believe them. But get this, with women, we, I think, have been believed more than we knew. We just weren't valued. They know these men do this. They do, I think, believe that these guys do this all the time. They just don't care. And they don't care because they don't care about us, and they don't care about what was done to us. And they think he matters, and we don't. And his career matters, ours doesn't. His reputation matters, ours doesn't. His further trajectory really counts. What would happen if we really put this guy in jail for this? What would happen to his life? This guy's life would go completely down the tubes. He would actually get raped, and I'm actually, by the way, very against that. But why don't, you know, they don't ask what already happened to her, what is going to happen to her at the point at which you say we don't believe her, and therefore this didn't happen, because we do believe her, but we don't care that he did it. Okay, so that's what I think is the real dynamic, and the piece that began to really shift here. People talk about credibility, but add in value. Do we count? I've been counting women, girls, accusing faculty men of sexual violation, including rape, for 40 years, okay? And my count is it takes minimum 3 or 4 of them to make any kind of a dent in his denial of having done it, okay? This makes us, by the way, 1/4 of a person for purposes of credibility in accusing sexual assault. And yes, there's huge numbers here, and there were huge numbers with Harvey Weinstein, so we don't really have a test of this. I mean, how many women does it take to make a dent in a high-level man's denial? And then everything about those women comes into this. Are they black? What if all of them are black? Where are you then? And it isn't really the credibility thing again, I don't think. It's called that because what people say, because they can say it, and judges will do it because it's unreviewable that they didn't believe them. I think they believe them, quite honestly. I think they think they know that it happened. They just don't think it matters. It shouldn't count. And you saw this with I think, the Anita Hill situation, where people were asked, do you believe Anita Hill? And I think they did, but said no, because they thought that the consequences to Clarence Thomas that were going to happen if she was taken seriously shouldn't happen, because they thought he should be appointed anyway. Okay, what happened with the Harvey Weinstein business is that really for the first time we saw powerful men siding with violated women who had reported their violation, what they were doing is they realized that their businesses couldn't survive anymore if they were transparently identified with these sexual abusers in the mainstream media. In other words, it was their reputation on the line all of a sudden. And it made them look bad. Instead of being a privilege of power, sexual harassment became a total disgrace. And they couldn't survive that disgrace. So instead of doing what they've done from time immemorial, which is get rid of the women, they got rid of the men. Now, you know, they abandoned these accused men who lost their jobs, their, at least for the moment, careers, books, movies, companies. All these are all consequences that with our civil rights laws, we could never sue for here. That's not part of what we can sue for, actually. In some enlightened places, like California, you can sue the perpetrator. Most places you can't. You can only sue the company. And in terms of suing the perpetrator, the company can still give him his job. You can't stop that. You can try, but it's not part of the cause of action. The whole idea of the civil rights remedy is to make the victim whole, but it doesn't do anything. It does not touch the perpetrator, and the company may decide that they can't afford this person anymore, or they, being that sex discrimination has never been about economic rationality, if it was, they would hire many more women than they do and simply pay us less, quite honestly, because they can get away with it. But they don't even hire us and pay us less. So obviously it's not about economic rationality. They don't, you know, they've got a whole set of other reasons for what they do. So they keep them. And they just move them around. And if anything happens, the victim is restored, the perpetrator isn't punished. And in other words, once women are sexually violated, once again, we have never been worth anything that these men are worth. Now, and this is what is changing. We're seeing it change right in front of our eyes. And this is what is happening on the level of sexual politics. And, you know, this is like the level of my politics, you know, the level that we work on. And then there's this other thing they call politics, which I call sexual politics, that is, you know, voting and elections and who's president and what happens in legislatures and all. And actually, in this instance, I think there is a crucial connection in why the Me Too movement has worked the way it has to conventional politics. And here's the way that looks. And again, this is just offered as for thinking. Editors of conventional media thought Hillary Clinton was going to win the presidency. And they were, I do know this, getting ready to cover women differently. This, however, did not, and I do know this also, include sexual abuse. They weren't thinking in those terms at all. And then Hillary lost. And it became astoundingly clear to those who were astounded that sex inequality is real. News, it apparently was. And the media actually took this to heart and criticized, at least a lot of it, much of it, criticized itself, did self-criticism for its share of the responsibility for the fact that a perpetrator in chief was to be commander in chief. And so what happened here is that sexual abuse flipped from what it had been at least since Clinton, which was a critique of the left, a critique of people on the left, at least, to actually a critique of the right. So that it became, being critical of sexual abuse became a way that one could be critical of 45, of Trump, which unleashed an awful lot of people who had been kept silent for a very long time because of what developed around how much more valuable other things are than women being sexually violated, namely Clinton's presidency and everything that follows thereon. And as a result, women and some women-friendly journalists, a.k.a. men, were permitted to cover sexual abuse for the first time. And most of them have been working on these stories for years. Ronan Farrow, by the way, had been working on all that for years as well. In my view, in other words, to put this very simply, if Hillary had won, which I would have preferred, Me Too is very unlikely to have taken place. Now, there are a bunch of legal issues here that some of which have been addressed to some extent, and a lot of which, if you look at them through the Me Too lens, are starting to shift and look different, and I'm just going to list them. One is there has been, as a result of the context of inequality highlighted for public conversation, we see, and it making sexual abuse possible, we've seen a lot more discussion about this question of consent, which was already in play around schools, including with the California law intervention on that subject. Its affirmative consent in education piece, as well as California laws, civil laws, embrace of the federal sexual harassment law, which actually uses the concept unwelcomeness, not consent. And I just highlight this because one potential consequence of the Me Too revelations might be to realize that we're over here litigating rape in the context of inequality in sexual harassment law and realizing that the concept of consent is essentially an unequal concept. It's about being rolled by power. It's about acquiescence under conditions of inequality. It includes actual desire, but usually the desire is a cover for an accused perpetrator in a situation where the last thing the woman wanted was whatever happened sexually between them. It's, you know, if somebody's having a wonderful sexual interaction with someone else and you're talking to your friends about it, you're saying how great it was last night, you don't say, I consented. And guys talking to each other about what a hot night they just had, don't say, she consented. You know, the word consent comes up when she says she was violated and he says, oh no, she consented. It's about, what is consent? It's about he says do this, and then she either does or doesn't have the ability to say yes or no. It's about active and passive. It's acted upon, and passively resisting or refusing or whatever, but you're already one down in the consent paradigm. That's why unwelcomeness was adopted even by the U.S. Supreme Court. As what equality looks like, in consent being intrinsically an unequal concept. And I think you don't get, you make a step to fix that in affirmative consent, but you don't effectively fix it because yes can also be coerced even if you are trying not to have that be the case and even write in law that it can't be and so on. But welcomeness has worked shockingly well, even though there are problems with it in sexual harassment law. So I'm suggesting that as something the Me Too movement has raised for consideration in rape law. I would also note briefly that one large cultural piece of the normalization of everything that happens in sexual harassment remains the unwillingness to either criticize culturally or address legally pornography, the industry. It is an industry of misogyny. It is out there now not only as the sex education source for most young men today, with women being dominated at the very least and violated and tortured and everything that is in there, but also they are doing, making pornography of the sexual harassment and rape that they are accomplishing. And in other words, they are becoming pornographers themselves, young perpetrators, thinking, and as one perpetrator, young perpetrator put it, no pick, didn't happen. In other words, you know, we may have thought, if anybody thinks rape means that women matter at all to men, check it out. We are a vehicle for them to communicate their dominance to each other. And the way they do it these days is by making pornography of themselves dominating us. And then they prove, and then they show it to other men. And that's at least as much a motivation for it all as anything else. Okay, I'm going to take 5 more minutes out of this just to give a few fast further legal notes on some of the ways that the institutionalization of Me Too's legal insights might be considered if you look at the law through the Me Too lens. Number one, we have Me Too and, well, we have sexual harassment law largely but not exclusively conceived as an equality law. In some places, it's seen as a dignity law. And just to be overly brief about this, I would just urge you to consider that dignitary violation is one feature of inequality. It is one measure of a violation of an equality right, but it is not the totality of what equality means. And it's a good part of the measure of damages. It's embedded in the status hierarchy problem that inequality is, if you recognize that inequality is about hierarchy. But there are a lot of other things than dignitary violations going on in this. And they are material, they are physical, they are social and structural. By the way, the word dignity, and it descends to us from the understanding that the ultimate violation of the Holocaust was deprivation of dignity. Myself, I would have thought it was extermination on the basis of who one is. I mean, that's what you're working back into when, you know, historically anyway, when we're talking about the place of dignity in human rights, the place of human rights in law, and in any event. One. Two, we are looking at a major moment in which the concept of employment at will, it seems to me strategically, might be getting to be reconsidered for the first time. This is the first time that white men have gotten treated the way we've been treated all along, in which they just don't kind of like the way you look. They fire you. Now, there are modifications in this in various places, but all of a sudden everybody's freaked out at the proportionality of the consequences being visited on these accused men without any due process, you know, without any anything. And, you know, I'm capable of thinking there should, you know, maybe some of that is a little hasty, and they better find out what actually happened, and they should look into it. I do think that. But in fact, in most places, they have an outright legal right to fire that person just because they don't like how it makes them look that someone has said that someone they employed raped them, or insisted they have sex with them as a condition of employment or whatever. This is called employment at will, and it is the law in most places. And without any qualifications, even though some place, and you can contract out of it in different ways and such. But anyway, thinking about backlash, reintegration of perpetrators, etc., I think we should just talk about that. Number three, statute of limitations has been shown to be insane on the federal level. California having 1 year is an improvement. You know, 3 years you get a statute of limitations if somebody hurt your property. 6 years most places for physical torts. I mean, under state law that can then be rolled into federal law. So anyway, 180 days, 240, 300 days, they are disappearing discrimination as fast as they can. And this is Congress, okay, who on federal law level who did this because they know how much of it there is. And this is, you know, in the meantime, everybody's saying what an outrage it is to hear in Me Too about all these women who were sexually harassed for the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, you know. So a tolling approach to this may be somewhat similar to what has been done with child sexual abuse, but not the same thing, not the same thing, because that won't work, but, you know, a tolling approach. Next, secrecy, confidentiality, non-disclosure agreements. I think Leslie Levy and I figured this out in the women's bathroom, which is where all good thoughts are figured out. No. And that is to say, first of all, it's, I think, important to make a distinction between non-disparagement going forward and any kind of secrecy, non-transparency, shutting up of the victim about facts that have already happened up to the moment. But the main thing I want to say about this, whatever it is one your position is about legislating it, is that I've negotiated these, she's negotiated these, you can negotiate that your victim can talk about what happened to her. And usually what people do is just cave when the other side says, but she's got to shut up about everything. And, you know, non-disparagement about new things that happen going forward is another matter. In addition to this, I would add for your consideration, multiple perpetration should be written in, and I've done this, into your agreements, and this is on plaintiff's side, but please consider being receptive to it, on defense side, of... if this guy does it again, that means defense side is responsible for telling you, because if it's reported to them, which is a trickiness. But there's also, not necessarily, because sometimes people find out about it later and not from either the company or the school. So there's that, and then there's violent perpetration. And where these are about is the other people problem. In other words, this guy isn't just a danger to her. This is an equality violation because he is a danger to people like her, everyone in her group. Because it's called on the basis of sex, not as a slogan, but because it is on the basis of sex. You can't solve this just by moving him over here or separating that over there. And in particular, if he's a violent perpetrator, other people have got to know about it. And so now the question is, can they know about him, but not about her? That's a possibility. You can do that. And finally about this, I want to say, I have actually, maybe these are the people who find me, but I have never met a survivor of sexual harassment who didn't want her story told. It's only a question of under what conditions, when, how, by whom, does she have control of it? And does she have backup? Does she trust that she's... Have you made yourself worthy of her story being out? That's what it is. And you as the company, you as the school, you as her lawyer, you know, will she take heart to speak out under what conditions? And I'm saying you can affect that. It isn't this fixed thing. It isn't like she's feels so humiliated, feels so ashamed, has all these cultural issues. Everybody has those, and they do vary. And they're worse some places than others, and for some people than others. But it really, really makes a difference how she's heard, how she's treated, and how she sees her environment. Joint perpetration, I think we need, you've got it here in California state law, civil, but almost nowhere else. Not in federal law, you can't sue him, as I mentioned. The liability standards in federal law are all screwed up. Again, they're better in California, but both in schools and in employment. In schools, it's deliberate indifference is the standard. That just means do more one thing more than nothing, and you're off the hook. This will not do. In employment, it means the victim has to report to the entity, which often means the perpetrator, or they aren't on the hook. What this is all about is this so-called vicarious liability. You know, you win a Nobel Prize, your school doesn't think it is vicariously responsible for it. They think they're going to call it theirs, right? If you're in the workplace and you do something brilliant, your workplace is going to take credit for anything good you do. You know, but you violate someone and the court calls it vicarious liability. I call it liability, is what it should be. And so you make it, the way you do that, the way you hook them in then, is you have to report to them. Because the idea is, how can they be responsible for something they didn't know about? Well, the answer is they created the context in which it occurred. They created the hierarchy. They created the incentives in which it was known that if they did it, nothing would happen. You know, they're responsible for their environment. So anyway, there's a lot to be said there. And finally, I don't think we're going to get anywhere until we have a meaningful Equal Rights Amendment in the United States. And it needs to be intersectional. It needs expressly. Look, you can't have a thing you call Equal Rights Amendment in this country and not have the word race in it. Think about it, right? Equal Rights Amendment. All the places we don't have equal rights need to be mentioned in this thing. And both together with sex and gender and on their own hook. And then everything that has been wrong about law needs to be corrected in it. And actually, Kimberly Crenshaw and I have written this thing. And looking for sponsors in Congress at present. And there are a couple of other prospects out there, too, that are good. Also, we could just get the existing Equal Rights Amendment and interpret it properly, except we could interpret it intersectionally, but we couldn't interpret it for race as such. So, well, that's what I have to say, and thank you all for your patience, and I look forward to your interventions.
We have...